From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. It's time now for NPR's Backseat Book Club, our monthly feature aimed at young readers. Our own Michelle Norris has been leading us on this reading adventure, and for February, she brings us two book selections.
One of the greatest things about being a reader is that over time, the books on your shelf seem to start talking to one another. There are echoing themes that resonate in new ways when they resurface. That's why we chose two books this month. We came across a recent book that seemed to speak directly to a much-loved children's classic that was published almost 70 years ago. Each book, in its own special way, deals with a special brand of childhood anxiety. No matter how old you are, no matter where you come from, memories of playground teasing can still cause your stomach to tighten. Our first book, a classic, captures that ache. The 100 Dresses was written by Eleanor Estes in 1944. It's about a Polish schoolgirl named Wanda Petronski. She's picked on by her classmates for her accent and her tattered clothes. The story was inspired by a classmate from Eleanor Estes' own childhood. Estes' daughter, Helena, explains that her mother never forgot those taunts.
As an adult, once she had become a writer, she figured that the only thing she could do was to write her story, since she didn't know where this person was or what had become of this person. And that in itself, I think, is very, very touching.
Over six decades, The 100 Dresses has touched generations with its poignant tale of bullies and bystanders. Helena Estes can attest to that. She's a children's librarian and says her mom's book is still quite popular. That's easy to understand because everyone at some point feels like an outsider. Our second outsider is much like a modern-day Wanda Petronski. His name is Fadi. He's 11 years old, and instead of Poland, he comes to America from Afghanistan. He's the central character in a book called Shooting Kabul. It's the story of how Fadi and his family flee Afghanistan to escape the Taliban in the summer of 2001. But not everyone made it out. During the harrowing journey, Fadi's little sister, Mariam, dropped her Barbie doll, and she got separated from the family just as they climbed onto a truck and sped away in the dark of night. Fadi carries the guilt because he let go of her hand.
His father's shame flowed over Fadi as the other passengers looked at Habib with pity. He had lost his sense of honor because he had not been able to protect his Namus, his daughter. But it wasn't his fault, thought Fadi. It was mine. I have no honor. I didn't protect Mariam.
Fadi lands in the U.S. with only a few cherished items, his favorite book and his camera. In fact, the title, Shooting Kabul, refers to the photos he loves to snap. Author Nahid Senzai explains how the little boy tries to fit in at his new school.
He joins a school where he stands out, is learning the customs and the language and trying to fit in. But then something terrible happens. 9/11 happens. And time changes. And he, being an Afghan, he being a Muslim, faces a lot of issues that happen in the grown-up world. And as we know, they trickle down onto the playground at school.
You know, you set out on a task that seems almost impossible for a book aimed at children, but you seem to have achieved this with grace and depth. You share a story of this little boy. He's an immigrant who's come to California from Afghanistan just before 9/11. And then on top of being, you know, an immigrant and an outsider, he's also wrestling with his sister who's missing and missing because of something he feels he did. So this is a story that's very deep and very emotional and very complex and yet completely accessible to kids. How did you manage to do that, to make sure that it was accessible to young readers?
One thing is that I always think kids are smarter than us in many ways. They may be in the background, they may be, as you say, be sitting in the back seat, but they know what's going on around in the world. And I thought if I could write a book about such serious topics as, you know, terrorism and have Osama bin Laden in a book, and if I can make children understand geopolitical, you know, realities of the world in a way that is very digestible for them and hopefully their families, I thought that that could be a very positive thing.
Nahid Senzai had never read The 100 Dresses, but immediately understood why we paired the two books once she picked it up
I saw such immense parallels between Shooting Kabul and 100 Dresses. It's about a girl named Wanda Petronski, who is a Polish immigrant and moves to a small town where she is ridiculed for having and wearing the same old blue dress. And the beauty of the book is, and how it's written, it's actually, a lot of it is from the perspective of the two girls who torment her. And then I thought about all the kids and immigrants in general who come to the United States. I thought of, you know, Polish immigrants and at that time during World War II, Germans and Japanese kids who were in the playground. And these themes of bullying and acceptance and immigrants and in becoming a part of the fabric in America is a theme that's played for many, many years.
You know, Wanda Petronski, the main character in The 100 Dresses, deals with her sorrows by drawing dresses, and Fadi turns to photography. And it's so interesting that for both of these characters, it's art that helps lift them through their darkest days. Is there something to that?
I think so. I think it's an outlet for expression. For Wanda, it's for, you know, showing the other girls that she really does have 100 dresses lined up in her closet. And for Fadi, he uses photography as a way of finding his sister.
That was Naheed Senzai, author of Shooting Kabul. Our other book was The 100 Dresses by Eleanor Estes. Two books, published decades apart, provide a powerful lesson. Even though America is a very different place than it was 70 years ago, children often face the same struggles to find a path toward acceptance and understanding. Now, before we say goodbye to February, one more quick thing. In honor of Fadi and his passion for photography, we asked you, our youngest listeners, to send us photos of the people and the places you love. We received hundreds of beautiful submissions. To see a sampling, visit our website, npr.org. It's worth a look. And now for March, we have a puzzling choice, The Mysterious Benedict Society by Arkansas writer Trenton Lee Stewart. It's a story chock full of conundrums and enigmas, and it focuses on four orphaned kids united by their genius, their eccentricities, and their quest to save the world. Happy reading. Michelle Norris, NPR News.
As always, we want to hear from our book club listeners, so please send in your questions about the Mysterious Benedict Society. Our email address is backseatbookclub@npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Los Angeles has decided to help kids get to class instead of fining them when they don't make it. The city has long had a tough stance on truancy, for a decade slapping huge fines on students for skipping school or even being late. But L.A. City Council is now changing that law because it turns out the fines were backfiring. Chrissy Clark from member station KQED reports.
2 years ago, Nabil Romero, a young Angelino with a thin black mustache, was running late to his first period class at a public high school on L.A.'s west side.
I lived two bus rides away from my school. The first bus ride took 45 minutes, the second one did as well. By the time I arrived school, I was approached by police officers and I was told to stop. I was handcuffed, searched.
Romero had to pay a $350 truancy fine. In a single-parent home like his, that was a lot.
When my mom heard the fine, she was like, oh, we're going to have to cut back on a lot of stuff. And we started cutting back on food expenses, on clothes expenses, shoes, and this was all my fault.
Well, maybe not all his fault. The ticket Romero got was for breaking the city of L.A.'s daytime curfew law, a law that critics say often punishes low-income kids making an honest effort to get to school. Manuel Criollo is an organizer with L.A.'s Community Rights Campaign. He says when he first started hearing stories like Romero's a few years ago, stories about police ticketing kids on their way to campus or rounding them up at bus stops,
To be honest, all of us were like, okay, are you guys literally saying they're at the bus stop? And we went out there, and yeah, you had police or school police basically waiting for young people to give them tickets.
Criollo's group got a hold of police data showing that in 5 years, officers issued 47,000 truancy tickets, most right next to schools in lower-income neighborhoods. Blacks and Latinos received a disproportionate number of the tickets compared to the makeup of the student population. The daytime curfew only applies to unaccompanied minors, and Criollo points out that in richer neighborhoods, tardy kids often escape tickets because their parents drive them to school. But kids in poor neighborhoods, they usually rely on public buses.
We want justice for our students. One, we are the people. Two, a little bit louder. Three.
At a recent rally, teacher Andrew Terranova explains that tickets meant to scare kids into going to school have had the opposite effect.
I had students who I would say, "What? Where were you yesterday? You were absent from my class, right? Oh, mister, I was late. I missed my connecting bus, so I went home. Why'd you go home? Well, I was afraid of getting another truancy ticket."
The fines were really crazy.
And that's coming from the guy who issues them, Michael Nash, the presiding judge for L.A.'s juvenile court, where most of the tickets and fines are handled and can quickly add up to thousands of dollars.
And we really weren't accomplishing anything.
The court's not going to solve that problem if kids are late to school. That's something for the schools to work out with the kids and the families.
So now, under the new daytime curfew law, police must avoid targeting students clearly headed to campus in the first 90 minutes of school. Steve Zipperman is the L.A. school police chief.
We have to take a look at what can we do to try and help us resolve the root problem of this rather than the Band-Aid approach of just writing the citation.
When tickets are issued, fines will be waived for the first two offenses, and students will have to work with counselors to come up with an attendance plan, looking into transportation issues or family stuff that might be getting in the way. City Councilman Tony Cardenas recently summed up the city's new approach to a crowd of students inside City Hall.
Young people, this is not a permission slip to be late. There are still our consequences. However, instead of purely punishing like the current system, we will be there for you. We will be there with you.
Believe it or not, Cardenas told them, an adult is actually going to talk to you and help you figure out how to get to school on time. For NPR News, I'm Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles.
And also reporting on that story, Susan Ferris of the Center for Public Integrity.
Now to the military's efforts to curate its image in popular culture. Exhibit A, the biggest movie in America right now, was born at the Pentagon.
Sir, leave two men here. Dos se quedan aquí.
Act of Valor was commissioned by the Navy's Special Warfare Command to play up its elite SEALs program. And it follows the Navy SEALs' remarkable moment in the spotlight, the killing of Osama bin Laden, and a huge spike in public interest. The unabashed propaganda film opened in theaters across the country Friday and earned nearly $25 million. We're going to look now at the long and complicated relationship between Hollywood and the Pentagon. Our tour guide is Jordan Zacharin. He's a staff editor with TheHollywoodReporter.com. Hi there, Jordan.
Hey, how are you?
So, Jordan, you've traced this relationship between the military and Hollywood, and you trace it back to 1927 and the film Wings. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that was actually the first Best Picture winner. The film got proposed to the Department of War, as it was called then. They liked it. They had a military veteran direct it, and the military gave them planes and guns and all those sorts of things that they still give today.
And you talk about, in your article, the different departments that were set up over the years to accomplish this at the Pentagon?
Yeah, World War II especially, they knew that, you know, the burgeoning medium of film was very important to get public support. So they had two departments, Bureau of War Information and another one that kind of looked over scripts and checked them, and then one that decided if you could export your film to foreign territories, which kind of means your film will be made or not. And they took over Disney Studio. He produced a lot of famous sort of propaganda films, and there was a lot of great, glory-filled films that if you look back on it today, a little bit of caricatures, especially the Japanese soldiers, but at the time, they really drove support and later on established an actual office for this permanently.
Now, I understand there was kind of a divorce between Hollywood and the military around the time of Vietnam that continued right up into the early 1980s with the release of Oliver Stone's Platoon, which was made actually with no help from the Pentagon. What happened there?
You know, Oliver Stone and Francis Ford Coppola, they did not want to work with the Pentagon and they didn't want to change their message. So it was a bit of a difficult time. But then Top Gun came out, made a lot of money, and they realized, wow, we could do this on the cheap, get a lot of promotion, and look real good.
Why was Top Gun the turning point?
Well, you know, it made a lot of money. A lot of it was because of Tom Cruise, but the military really worked with Jerry Bruckheimer on that, and they had recruitment tables outside of the theaters. And I think what happened was that it was long enough, like 10 years after the Vietnam War ended, that you know, filmmakers and studios realized that they could do this a little bit on the cheaper side and make a lot of money. And ultimately, that's beyond message. That's what it comes down to in Hollywood.
You've talked about the things that directors can get in terms of the props and scene mm-hmm. settings. What does it mean creatively in terms of script approval or the screening that the Defense Department might do for the story and plot?
Well, they require 5 copies of a script, and they go over it and tell you what can and can't be in there. They say it has to be informative and has to be true. It has to help in recruitment. They don't want a movie that would make the U.S. look bad, even if, you know, it's based on a true story. There was one called Wind Talkers about World War II and people in Japan, and they had a character called the Dentist, and he would take gold fillings out of fallen Japanese soldiers' teeth. And even though it was true, that didn't really reflect well in the military, so they had them take that out.
Jordan, the makers of the film Act of Valor have said that there's still a sort of anti-military ideology in Hollywood and in mm-hmm. entertainment. At the same time, I see films that have the support of mm-hmm. the Pentagon coming out all the time. Right. I mean, what kind of phase are we in now?
Well, I think the ideology ultimately is what makes money. You know, we've seen a lot of movies that, you know, very good. Hurt Locker, one of them, Jarhead, a number of films that fell short of the box office despite being critically acclaimed. Maybe Hollywood's realizing that maybe people don't want to see difficult war on their TV screen after seeing it, you know, 24/7 on CNN, on Fox News. So maybe now they're into a little bit of escapist entertainment. You've got Battleship coming out with Peter Berg, a Zac Efron movie called The Lucky One, a little bit of a romance there. You know, especially as the war is ending and we're in a kind of a support our troops mode, they're going to be less focusing on the renegade or difficulties that happen in Iraq and elsewhere.
That's Jordan Zacharin. He's a staff editor with TheHollywoodReporter.com. Jordan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. More positive economic news today. The economy was growing faster at the end of last year than previously thought. Add to that, a closely watched manufacturing index was up sharply. But the news was not all good. Stocks ended down for the day. NPR's John Itzty reports that's partly because the highlights were followed by a relatively glum assessment of the U.S. economy from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke.
The economic mood has been brightening recently with stronger job growth, sharp drops in the unemployment rate, an easing of the debt crisis in Europe, and a stock market surge. This morning, before Chairman Bernanke began testifying at the House Financial Services Committee, the day's positive data on economic growth in manufacturing had sent stocks higher. But stocks reversed course as Chairman Bernanke sat down at the witness table and began delivering lines like this one.
The fundamentals that support spending continue to be weak. Real household income and wealth were flat in 2011, and access to credit remains restricted for many potential borrowers.
And then he said this.
Notwithstanding the better recent data, the job market does remain far from normal.
And Bernanke said continuing improvement on the jobs front will require stronger growth than we've had recently. The Fed's growth forecast of around 2.5% for 2012 suggests progress will be slow for the rest of the year. Despite Bernanke's somewhat gloomy tone, many analysts are convinced the U.S. economy is gaining momentum and that the Fed's intention to hold interest rates near zero until the end of 2014 will have to be reconsidered. But Bernanke did not back off that date in his testimony. He did acknowledge that policymakers are evaluating the recent positive economic data, suggesting there could be a reassessment. The Fed chairman did express some optimism that credit is beginning to flow from banks. That came in response to a question from Republican Thaddeus McCotter of Michigan.
We still have trouble getting money down into the hands of people for credit, into the hands of people who can grow this economy and get jobs back.
I guess I would just make one observation, which was the news this morning that bank lending increased last quarter at the fastest rate since the recession.
Bernanke also said that European governments had taken a number of constructive policy actions aimed at solving their debt crisis, and he said the mild recession in Europe should not have a big impact on the U.S. recovery. As for America's own debt problems, Bernanke continued to press Congress to produce a credible plan to get the deficits and debt under control, but not implement it so quickly that it derails the recovery. And he warned them of looming danger at the beginning of next year. That's when the Bush tax cuts and payroll tax holiday expire, and automatic spending cuts agreed to by the President and Congress take effect.
On January 1st, 2013, there's going to be a massive fiscal cliff of large spending cuts and tax increases. I hope that Congress will look at that and figure out ways to achieve the same long-run fiscal improvement without having it all happen at one date.
If Congress fails to act, Bernanke said, the shock could derail the economy. John Idsty, NPR News, Washington.
Microsoft is gearing up for what's described as its most important product launch in 17 years. Windows 8 reimagines what working with a Microsoft device feels like. The company hopes this new operating system will help Microsoft break into the world of mobile devices, where it's fallen far behind its rivals Apple and Google. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
For decades, Microsoft and Intel dominated the personal computing industry by working hand in hand. Microsoft wrote software designed to run on Intel's chips, and Intel powered almost all personal computers. But when the computing world went mobile with the iPhone, the iPad, and Android, Microsoft's Windows platform was left in the dust. And really, to understand why, you have to get inside these machines. Those Intel chips in your old PC are kind of like gas-guzzling muscle cars from the 70s, fast and powerful, but inefficient. Mobile phones and tablets need chips that run more like a Prius. They need chips that sip juice from a battery instead of swilling it. Wednesday, at a trade show in Barcelona, Microsoft unveiled its newest operating system, Windows 8. It still works with Intel, but it will also run on energy-efficient ARM chips.
I think the thing that was really compelling is the number of devices that you saw.
Brendan Barnicle is an analyst who follows Microsoft at Pacific Crest Securities.
You know, you saw some enormous monitors, incredible ultra-thin laptops, lots of variations in tablets.
Windows 8 works with a mouse or a touchscreen on a tablet or a PC.
And the key thing for Microsoft with the move to the tablet is it's going to be their way to move into the phone. Almost the exact opposite of what we saw Apple do, where Apple took the experience on the iPhone and then expanded it out onto the iPad. Microsoft's doing just the opposite. They're hoping that your experience on their tablet is going to be so good that you may reconsider looking at their phone.
Microsoft won't ship Windows 8 until later this year, but if you're curious, you can download a consumer preview right now. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's follow up now on the death of the conservative media publisher Andrew Breitbart. He has died at the age of 43. A statement on his website, bigjournalism.com, says he died of natural causes. We're going to talk about this with Dave Weigel, a journalist for Slate, who knew Mr. Breitbart. Mr. Weigel, I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah, I'm having trouble talking to the people in Breitbart's network today. We're all, I'm not counting myself among them, and the people who literally worked with him, they're confident that the media operation he built is going to move on, but they just no one knows what to do when somebody who's 43 dies of natural causes.
Well, some people will know his name very well. He was very prominent. He was in the news. He was sometimes behind the news, but some people will never have heard his name before. Who was Andrew Breitbart?
Well, Andrew Breitbart was a media entrepreneur, and in a real sense, I mean, he invented things. He invented elements of media that did not exist before. Of the press, not of the ways, the tools we use for it. And he kind of was a he would probably disagree with this characterization, but kind of a protege of Matt Drudge. He worked on the homepage of the Drudge Report for a while. And I think through that kind of mind-melded with how he already kind of had a sense of how the internet works, but he's one of the people who really came into his own as people began getting their information in new ways and things being curated, things being hyped. It was, you know, once kind of tabloid journalism was hyped up by the internet. Then he founded the Big Sites in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
We found a video site first. I'm skipping past how he co-founded the Huffington Post. But we found the Big Sites is when he moved in to real original stuff. I mean, he had a team of people who, starting with somebody who made independent video for him, well, not a staffer, James O'Keefe,
mm-hmm.
really starting with the big government, the launch of that Acorn video. I mean, he kind of moved into this role as not just a publisher of conservative investigative journalism and muckraking, but as an icon in the conservative movement. I mean, today you're seeing Mitt Romney comment on his death, and you're seeing Daryl Issa, who runs the Oversight Committee in Congress, and
mm-hmm.
Followed up on some of the things Breitbart reported on.
You've just alluded to the fact that he worked for the Drudge Report in the 1990s, which was a pioneering site in its time for breaking stories on the web and emphasizing stories on the web, that he was involved in founding the Huffington Post, that he ended up founding his own websites and spreading video and backing people doing various projects. His website, although I think it's notable, his website, in announcing his death, quotes him as saying once, "I enjoy making enemies." This was a guy who was happy to be in a fight.
He was. I mean, he was happy to be in a fight, and he was also happy to talk about it. I mean, the thing I'm trying to wrestle with today is going back to my memory banks, just think of the many times he would just call me or call a journalist and talk for 20 minutes about the fight he was currently engaged in or about the importance of something or how we were missing something. He was, fearless is a word, is a word that he would have laughed if it was applied to him. But, he really kind of, because he operated outside the strictures of the conservative movement and built his own little island outside of it, he just did not care about who he offended. I mean, his last big project was the cracking down on a members of Congress who were getting information about economic transactions and then buying or selling stock based on that. And he's a Republican, and he was very gleeful about trying to embarrass Spencer Baucus, who the banking committee chairman of the House, who was a Republican. He was trying to go after Republicans too. There was a playfulness about it. I remember for a while, Eric Bollert, was one of the staffers at Media Matters,
mm-hmm.
which was always engaged in war with Breitbart.
They're more to the left, of course. Yeah,
they're to the left.
Just got about Bollert's, 10 seconds here.
Bollert's avatar was, him smiling with a beard in front of a tree, and Breitbart changed his own avatar to him with a beard in front of a tree just to mock him. He loved to retweet people who attacked him. I mean, he was a true original who just was proud and brave about what he did.
Okay. Dave Weigel, thanks very much.
Thank you.
He's telling us about the death of Andrew Breitbart at 43.